versus Gaines, number 17-3270. And Ms. Nichols for the public defender. You may proceed when you're ready.
Good morning. I'm Paige Nichols on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Gaines. May it please the court. I'd like to begin today at the beginning, which is the question of when was Mr. Gaines seized in the parking lot on the morning of the events in question. And to establish a seizure, we have to establish that there was both a show of authority on the part of the police and that Mr. Gaines submitted to that authority. So I'd like to begin just by talking about the evidence that is shown primarily through, and most importantly through, the two recordings that have been submitted to the court and that the district court considered below. Those were the dash cam recording from Officer Rowland's car and the poll camera from the parking lot. So the poll camera gives us this sort of bird's eye wide angle view of the events, and the dash camera gives us the up close view plus the words that were exchanged. So to begin with, as we're thinking about whether the officers made a show of authority, let's start with just how they approached. The first officer to come into the parking lot was Officer Rowland, and he drove in quite quickly and directly to Mr. Gaines's car. And he stopped his car with the emergency lights flashing very close to Mr. Gaines's car and aimed at it. He opens the door of his car, and he comes out. And I'm sorry, this next fact I did not note in my brief. I did let the government know I was going to bring it up here. But you can see Officer Rowland when he gets out of the car. It looks like maybe they're making eye contact because Mr. Gaines was leaned back, and then he leans forward and looks out the window. And then Officer Rowland does this. He makes a gesture with his hand. Come here. Come on out. And right at that point, after the gesture, Mr. Gaines gets out of his car. Meanwhile, second officer...
Let me stop you right there. Is it your position that he was seized? There was a show of authority with the lights off of Officer Rowland's car, and he yielded when he got out in response to the gesture?
Yes. So, and in addition to those two facts are the fact that at the same time he's getting out of the car, the second officer is coming up. Her lights are on, and she gets out. Both of these officers are...
The briefing says her lights are on, but I watched the videos and her lights don't appear to be flashing.
It's hard to see them. She says that her lights were on in her testimony.
Yeah, I know she says that.
And I agree. It's.
I didn't see them either.
Right. So I don't know whether they were on when she pulled in and then she turned them off, or whether the sun is just hitting her car at just the right angle, which I think is a possibility from the video. But I agree, it's hard to tell. She did testify they were on. And they're both fully uniformed. They're wearing their tactical vests. They've got their big belts with all their things hanging off their belts.
Is it your position the seizure happened when the lights came on Roland's car?
I think this court can find that, but you can also wait until the moment that they are standing right up close to him and say it occurs then as well, because he continues to submit at that point, and at that point he can certainly see their uniforms and their tactical vests. And meanwhile, Officer Rowland leaves his car door open, which is sort of another signal that, look, this officer is ready to jump in this car and make chase if I go anywhere.
The officer testified he turned the lights on because he was blocking the through lane in the parking lot.
Sure, but that doesn't matter to this court's analysis, because the analysis is what the reasonable person in Mr. Gaines's position would take those lights to mean. And when they are pointed at him...
Why wouldn't a reasonable person take it to mean it was a warning, a safety warning for other motorists?
Because of the angle of the cars, the fact that they're pointed at him, the fact that the officer is giving him this hand gesture, the fact that there are two officers, they didn't just pull in and you know, stop generally at some open space in the parking lot. They pulled up to him, and that is clear. So it is our position that by the time they have walked up to Mr. Gaines, and they're quite close to him, especially Officer Rowland is quite close to him. In fact, as the government said later during the trial to the district court, they encircled him, right? But even if not by then, by the time the officer asks him, are you up here selling drugs, it's certainly a seizure by then, although I think it can be found a seizure before then because of those emergency lights. And especially when you add in the gesture and the uniforms and the two officers and the angles of their car.
Do you think it would make any difference if instead of this occurring in a parking lot that Mr. Gaines had been walking down a street and the officer pulled up, you know, next to the curb, turned on the lights, got out, and then asked him for ID?
I think you have pretty close to the same situation there. I mean, again, it depends on how close does he pull up. Is there a second officer that pulls up? Is he in his uniform? And does he do more than just ask for the ID? Does he say, somebody told me you're selling drugs? Because that's not just a general accusatory, hey, we're checking the area for drugs. We think you're selling drugs. Sorry, I didn't mean to point at you, Your Honor. And so it's a pretty specific accusatory question. And I did want to mention, as we're talking about those lights and what other situations would the lights be a show of authority, I wanted to mention the Salazar case, because this case is very close to that case with just one little exception. So in Salazar, you have, that's the TP Junction case. And in Salazar, there was a pickup in a parking lot, and it was sitting there parked. And a trooper drives over to the parking lot and drives toward the pickup. The pickup starts to drive away, and then the trooper activates his emergency lights. And this court held that activation of emergency lights there was a seizure. And so, it's this tiny little piece of difference in that Mr. Gaines's car remained parked. He didn't start to drive away. So that Salazar is probably one of our strongest Tenth Circuit cases on the question, but like every other seizure question, it's a combination of all the circumstances, and we think we've got them here.
In Salazar, one of the things they talk about is that where the suspect's temporary hesitation or, you know, delay right before they make a mad dash, that they're not necessarily yielding under those circumstances. Do we have that here where Mr. Gaines is just sort of playing out the system until he can grab his bag and run?
I don't think that this case can be decided. I think this court has to find that Mr. Gaines submitted unless you find a way to distinguish it from Morgan or overrule Morgan, because Morgan is pretty close to this, but the guy in Morgan didn't stop and answer as many questions as Mr. Gaines did. I mean, he said one thing. The officer says, hold up, and Mr. Morgan replied, what do you want? And then starts to back away. That was sufficient submission under Morgan, under cases cited in Morgan, cited since Morgan, and I think that's the law that has to apply here.
Let me ask you a somewhat related question. Apart from the yielding to authority, now, I know that you say, and I think that this is right, that on whether or not there was a seizure that we applied de novo review, but it's also predicated to some extent on historical facts. And so what do we do in applying de novo review to the fact that the district judge in the written ruling specifically found that it was a consensual encounter predicated to some degree on the conversational tone of the officers? So in applying de novo review, how do we incorporate into our analysis these findings on historical facts?
Right. So I think there is a pretty fine line between what's a historical fact and what's a final finding. But I think a finding that an encounter is consensual is a legal finding that this court reviews de novo. So what do you do with the fact that the district court found that the officer used a conversational tone? Well, that's fine. He used a conversational tone. But note that his voice register drops a little bit when he says, we got a call about you, man, and asks him that question. So it does change a little bit. And the district court just simply didn't discuss the nature of that questioning, but you can also take into account all the other circumstances. That's just one circumstance. The fact the officer's not yelling at him, I agree, but that's just one circumstance. And the totality of circumstances show many more shows of, you know, aspects that are showings of authority, including the lights and the Khmer and the uniforms and so forth. So I don't think that the district court's factual findings prevent this court from making the legal finding de novo that we're asking it to make. And to the extent that this brings up the standard of review, reviewing the district court's decision in the light most favorable to the government, I think that probably that our argument about why this court need not continue to apply that standard is probably best summarized in our reply brief. And so I'll rely on that unless Your Honors would like to talk about that right now. Okay. The second...
Yeah, you have, you know, turning to the, if it's not consensual, whether there was an appropriate investigatory stop.
Yes.
And, you know, really two questions that I think are related. Why isn't the 911 call, and, you know, is there enough level of detail there to get us to a, you know, some level of suspicion? And then maybe perhaps, you know, combining it with the facts of Utah versus Streif, and I think the officers had some knowledge that there had been previous PCP drug overdoses at this
yes.
location.
Sure.
Why doesn't the all those add up to maybe at least sufficient grounds to stop and ask for ID?
First, I have to say, and I know my brief makes this clear, that we think that question should be remanded because the district court didn't make full fact findings on it. But if this court decides that question, I think that the most important thing that distinguishes this case from the Navarette case, and remember, the U.S. Supreme Court said Navarette was a close case, was the fact that that 911 caller had a basis of knowledge, and she shared that basis of knowledge with the police. This guy ran me off the road. Right? It happened to her, whereas this caller says, we got a guy down here selling wet. He doesn't say, I saw him selling.
Well, but I'm watching him right now. He says, I'm watching him right now.
Right, but he doesn't say he's watching him sell. He says, I'm watching him right now, and then he tries to predict some behavior, and he's wrong about it. But he doesn't say, I saw him sell drugs, or how I know he made either $20 or $40. I hear
20.
It different. I heard 20. but... the basis of knowledge does not have the clarity that it has in Navarette. And remember, he doesn't know. I mean, he says you should find him at his car because, well, I don't know why, and I don't know what kind of car he's in today. So there are things he doesn't know, and it's
well, he's clearly watching him because he says he's walking to his car right now.
He's watching when he makes the 911 call. I agree.
Yes, and he says I can't see the car, but I can see him walking to the car. So, I mean, he appears to be giving a contemporaneous account of watching this guy. Doesn't that give a little more believability to the call?
It just tells us that he knows there's a guy dressed in red out there. And that was the problem in JL, too, was, yeah, you can describe what this person looks like and where they are, but those are innocent things. We need a little bit more on the question of whether there was a crime and whether this person committed the crime. I want to, actually, I'd like to reserve my time and hope to get to talk about Streif when I get back up here.
Certainly you may.
Thank you.
Let's hear from the U.S. Attorney for Kansas. Welcome.
May it please the court. The court can affirm the district court's
decision. Could you identify your name real quick, please?
Oh, Stephen McAllister.
I should have done that, yeah.
Yep. And I think you may need to pull that up
a bit. Okay. All right, again, Stephen McAllister, U.S. Attorney for the District of Kansas. May it please the court. The court can affirm the district court's ruling on three different grounds, any one of which is sufficient. Can agree with the district court's conclusion that this was a consensual encounter. It could also agree with the district court's conclusion that there's an attenuation here under Utah versus Streif, or it could affirm on the ground that was fully aired below, that there was reasonable suspicion in any event for this encounter. As far as standard of review and the question how you review the lower court's findings, clearly the facts, it's clearly erroneous, and this court's case is stated in somewhat different ways, but I think it's really the same standard. It's really saying we give deference to the district judge who was there, heard the testimony, saw the witnesses, and to the prevailing party.
Well, are you arguing that on whether or not there was a seizure, that we do anything other than apply de novo review?
I mean, the ultimate conclusions are right. De novo, but the underlying historical facts are clearly erroneous. And you know, I don't know where this court might like me to start, but on the
I'd like to start with the emergency lights.
The emergency
lights.
That's
sort of a bright line in this case.
It's a bright light.
It's a bright light.
Figuratively and literally.
No, I think if you look at that, which obviously you have seen that videotape, that parking lot, actually the larger part of the parking lot is where Mr. Gaines was parked. The other part is narrower. There's an alley that you can't really see, and then there's Nebraska Street where the officer enters. And if you watch that video, you'll notice that, or at least the dash cam of the officer and the video, frankly, there was a white van that pulled out just before the officer pulled in. So he certainly knew that people could be driving through that parking lot.
Well, I mean, if you were in a car and a police car pulled up behind you with the lights flashing, would you really think that you were free to leave?
I'm the U.S. attorney. I wouldn't.
So. I mean, isn't that the test? We're supposed to look at whether a reasonable person would feel free to leave when a police officer pulls up behind them with their lights flashing and motions for them to get out of the car. I mean, I'm having a little trouble thinking that a reasonable person would step on the gas and say, not talking to you.
Well, Your Honor, I think, you know, as the district court concluded, Mr. Gaines quickly exited the car and did not feel constrained in his movements, obviously. I mean, he moved back and forth.
He quickly exited the car because he was told to exit the car.
The officer did make the gesture. I agree with that. But that doesn't mean that in and of itself he had been seized at that point in time. He was able to step out of the car. The officer engaged him, said, "Do you have any ID?" He then started what I think was ultimately his plan to escape by, "I don't have it, I think it's in the trunk." He never went to the trunk. He goes back and eventually grabs his inventory in the black bag and flees with it. The officer never put hands on him. And if you look at the totality of the circumstances that this court has always used for a seizure, it's a very public place. There's lots of other people around. The officer does not show weapons. Like I said, he does not physically touch the defendant at any point.
What if we were to say, Mr. McAllister, you are right, and we're going to issue a published opinion saying that at least in the state of Kansas, if you are immobile in a vehicle and two police cars come up with their flashing lights, and the officer gets out to walk to your car, that you legally are entitled to just drive off. Based on your position in this litigation, would that be amenable to you?
I think that would be, and then the officer is in the position of deciding whether to pursue, and at that point we will definitely have a seizure if the officer
pursues.
So literally
you're saying that as a matter of law, in the six states comprising our circuit, that anyone can just legally drive off when two police cars come up to you with flashing lights, get out to come to your vehicle, but if you and you can drive off, but if you are going 1 mile per hour, then you would be subject to the Kansas law saying, no, you have to stop.
Because that's what the Kansas law covers. I mean, it is thinking about the moving vehicle that is being stopped, or the hypothetical, the defendant's walking down the sidewalk and the officer, I would analogize that to the moving vehicle. You're clearly indicating, I want to stop you, and you're in motion. But here, there was no motion, and I think that the way we'd handle that, perhaps, Judge Backrock, is if that person drove off, then the officers have to decide, do I have reasonable suspicion to go ahead and stop this person? And then the whole argument is no longer about consensual, but it is about reasonable suspicion if they go ahead and stop the person.
There was a case in Kansas, and I don't know that it was cited, but Kansas versus Morris. And if you're familiar, if you're not familiar, I don't want to, it's not a test, but the Kansas Supreme Court said, few, if any, reasonable citizens while parked would simply drive away and assume that the police, in turning on the emergency flashers, would be communicating something other than for them to remain, end quote. Why should we not abide by that?
Well, that's principle. Kansas court. Obviously, it does not bind the federal courts.
But to use to elaborate on Judge McHugh's question, this person is in Kansas, right? And so this person, in determining whether or not they would feel free to leave, would be observing Kansas law, right? I mean,
you'd be observing
entitled to drive off under Kansas law, aren't we obligated to abide by that?
But I think there's a slight difference. I don't think the court was saying you're not entitled to drive off. It was saying, as a Fourth Amendment matter, you might not feel free to leave. It was not construing the Kansas statute to say you did not have the right to drive off. So that's how I would distinguish that. Yeah. And if you decide that this case is not consensual, as I said, there are two other grounds on which to affirm.
Let's turn to attenuation.
Sure.
One of the elements that we look at in attenuation is intervening circumstances. How can something be an intervening circumstance if it wasn't discovered before the discovery of the evidence that was seized in violation of the Fourth Amendment?
Well, Your Honor, I think because the defendant's own conduct precluded that discovery. I mean, had the defendant actually produced the license first thing and allowed the officers to run the check, they would have immediately found the warrant, as they testified, and there's no reason
but
to doubt
already,
that.
But they already, let's say we disagree with you about whether it was consensual, and so we already have a Fourth Amendment violation, right?
Right. Okay. But that's why you'd need the attenuation. So assume it's an unlawful stop, but at that point he fled, and his own misconduct precludes the officers from finding that warrant.
I thought he was entitled to leave.
Well, if it was consensual, he could have gotten in the car and driven away.
So it really wasn't his fault, because he was just doing what he was legally entitled to do.
Except once he engaged in the encounter, the officers pretty quickly saw the open container of alcohol and smelled the PCP, and at that point they had reasonable suspicion. In fact, they had probable cause
to
arrest on
it. So I didn't mean to talk over you, but 45 seconds earlier, before they opened the door and they smelled the PCP, if he had run off, then the police would have been in the same situation. Then they would not have otherwise learned of the existing warrants because of his misconduct, because he was entitled to do that. It was only in this 30-second period where they opened the door and they smelled the PCP in the trunk and through the open door. So it really wasn't his fault that caused the inability to learn of the warrants. It was just the fortuitousness of it was 30 seconds that it lasts.
Well, again, if he had fled immediately, then it changes to a question where the officers have to assess, do we have reasonable suspicion to go seize him now? And then we'd be having that argument. But he did not flee. And I would submit, again, his actions showed lack of submission to authority. And I will also say, he is a big fellow. I mean, he was much larger than either of these officers. And he said, it's in the trunk. He opens that latch. He never gets to the trunk. He goes back. At that point, the officer sees the bottle, open bottle, and I think it's completely reasonable for the officers to want to be near the door when this big guy is rooting around in the car and they don't know what he's got in there. And then at that point, when he sees the bottle and says, okay, I'm going to have to detain you, well, it's pretty clear the defendant then had his plan already that he was going to run, but he wanted his inventory before he ran. And so all of that prevented what could have been a simple record check if he'd have produced the ID in the first place.
Getting back to Judge McHugh's question, I'm still not sure why this alternative, what your adversary calls this alternative universe theory, has to do with whether or not factually this is an intervening circumstance, because it seems to me that you're arguing inevitable discovery.
Well, I think it's that sort of thing.
But you've never argued inevitable discovery.
I agree that it's not in the briefs, but as I've thought about the case, that is certainly what it sounds like. Because if they had run the warrant check, they would have had the authority to arrest him.
So if they had run the warrant check, and he is 3 feet away, let's say, from the vehicle, we don't know where he would have been in this alternative universe, because, you know, it's alternative. And so if he had been 3 feet away, then the police could have searched him. Well, he didn't have anything on him, right?
Right, but they could have impounded the car. They had the
well, under Sanders, you might or might not have been able to impound the car. But
if it weren't an inventory search based on the fact that, not an inventory search, but under this alternative universe theory, that you could search him and only search the car if he is within reach. Well, he may or may not have been within. He had long arms because he was a big guy, but he may may or may not have been able to reach into the vehicle. So I don't know how you can say that even under this alternative universe theory, under a search incident to the arrest, that the police still would have found the pouch.
Well, I think, again, I guess it depends perhaps on the point in time. At the point they saw the open container, they would have found it all because they would have had the right to seize the container. Yeah, that would have put them in the car where they'd have seen everything.
But he had either been seized or not.
But, Your Honor, I guess I appreciate your point that the attenuation argument is tricky. And obviously in Utah versus Streiff, the Supreme Court did not purport to address this situation, although it was acknowledging, at least, I think, that it might be an attenuation situation, or they could have said this will never be attenuation.
They left it open. But all through their opinion, they talk about discovery of the warrant. I mean, it's like everywhere in their opinion.
Well, and I guess the other factor the court might consider in that is there are a couple of Fourth Circuit cases that I think we cite, and I'd have to go back to the brief. I know one is Sprinkle. I'm drawing a blank on the other name. But there's one in which the initial stop is viewed as unlawful, but then the passenger flees the car and actually even shoots at the officer trying to catch him, and the court says, well, you know, the defendant's own misconduct can attenuate the taint of the unlawful stop, which was to seek drug activity. So once you start shooting at officers, that's different. That's happened afterwards. And here the defendant didn't shoot at officers, but he did at least make contact with Officer Roland as he pushed past him with the bag and fled down the hill. And certainly, in and of itself, that could be assault of a law enforcement officer. But the point being, courts should be careful, I would argue, in using the attenuation and the Streiff notion not to reward defendants for misconduct in the sense of subsequent crimes they may commit after what is an unlawful stop, because that just sort of gives them a free pass after they've been stopped to do things and they just say, oh, well, it's all connected back to the stop and therefore you can't use anything you found. But as I said, there are three bases on which the court can affirm the district court. So attenuation, I think, legally is the trickiest, and it's certainly the most uncharted water here. But the consensual search, which is what the district
court... What do we do about the anonymous 911 call?
I'm glad you asked that, Your Honor, because I think here, this is not just an anonymous call. I mean, this bears indicia of reliability that may not be typical. For one thing, the caller used 911, so you know it's going to be recorded. You know you're going to get an official response. Contrary to my colleague, I think the conversation makes clear this person had seen at least one drug transaction. Otherwise, how does he know he just made $20? He's describing what the person's doing, his clothing to a T, and furthermore, when the dispatch goes out, the off-duty officer across the street adds to that and tells the officers, yes, I see him. You know, he's been over in that parking lot. He's in that car. So you've also got, you know, another, and somebody besides the caller saying, yes, this guy's here. He's been hanging around
in
this lot.
But isn't it a lot like JL? I mean, you know, we can clearly identify him. That the caller says he has a gun. JL sure sounds like the caller is observing him standing at the bus stop wearing
the
clothes.
It's kind of like, but I would say distinguishing factors are, again, you've got the 911 call, you've got him saying, that basically saying, I've witnessed recent criminal activity, a drug transaction by this person. He's walking back up the hill. The person has to go inside and ask the address, which suggests he is there watching him. He just doesn't know the exact address of the location. And you know, I think putting it plus with all the incident reports, that you didn't have in JL. You didn't have the police had been called to that bus stop 8 times for people having guns at the bus stop. Here you've got at least...
Well, it would be people having bullet wounds.
at the bus stop.
If there was evidence that like that could corroborate. But here there is that evidence. Here's the evidence of all the calls to this very parking lot in this center for these drug overdoses, complaints. Both officers, the off-duty and Officer Roland, testified that they also were aware of complaints of narcotic sales at this location, that the department had engaged in investigations at this location. They did not know that Mr. Gaines was ever identified, but they knew there had been investigations of narcotic sales at this location. And I frankly, you know, it comes down to common sense. It's an interesting case to me, not least because this is a block from the federal courthouse in Kansas City, Kansas. So I drive by this parking lot
all the time.
And, you know, there are lots of people just sort of around, and these officers know the territory, and I think to a great extent they're using their common sense. So I would urge the court to affirm either because it agrees it's consensual or that they had reasonable suspicion. I'm happy if you want to say it's attenuated, but I think that's the most difficult territory for the court to tackle. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. McAllister. Jane, could you give 3 minutes?
A couple of quick thoughts about attenuation and inevitable discovery. So we know we've got the seizure here and the discovery of evidence here. And attenuation asks, was there an intervening circumstance? Well, let me back up and go to inevitable discovery. The question, if this is an inevitable discovery case, which it's not because the government waived that, but if we think about it as inevitable discovery, the question there is not what would have happened if Mr. Gaines had behaved differently. It's what would have happened had the Fourth Amendment violation not occurred. And under Nix, the inevitable discovery doctrine involves no speculation, no speculative elements, but focuses on demonstrated historical facts capable of ready verification. And the question, again, is what would have happened had the illegality not occurred, not had the defendant behaved differently? That question's not answered here. On attenuation, then, we've got the seizure and we've got the discovery of evidence. Is there an intervening circumstance? The government says, well, yeah, we recognize that the warrant was discovered later, but there was the flight, and at points in their brief they mention abandonment. But they don't put that into any kind of a structured legal analysis. The only kind it would really fit into is attenuation by flight or attenuation by abandonment. But they never make that argument, and they never talk about King. The government says today, you can't give this guy a free pass. He fled. Well, this court's already given that free pass in King. It's not a free pass. The point is that if the flight occurs after illegal conduct by the police, then the burden is on the government to establish both that this was an independent and voluntary flight and to put that argument into the attenuation structure. They haven't done that here. They can't win on that argument here. I don't know if they could have won it if they'd argued it below, but they never did. We've got no argument that the flight was independent. And King sets out those factors, and King cites a number of other cases. This is well-established law in this circuit. So that's attenuation. Quick mention about the 911 call. And I understand that Navarette says that the fact that somebody uses 911 adds to the reliability of the call. But it's just one factor. And again, let's remember, Navarette was a close call. And I don't think it's true that in 2018, when somebody calls 911, they necessarily know that their call can be traced. People use spoof apps that send out a different telephone number. People use burner phones. People borrow cell phones. Cell phones are so fungible. In this day and age, it's not at all clear that a caller thinks that their call is easily traceable. And the government never made any effort here, or law enforcement never made any effort here to trace that call before officers responded or to ask that caller for his name or any other information. And last point about the fact that poor people who go to seek help at a food kitchen and a social services agency might be on drugs. We might as well hold that hospitals are high crime areas because people go there with gunshots and other wounds, having been victimized. So the question is whether there were sales. I think I've run out of my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Nichols. Appreciate the arguments. Case shall be submitted. And the counsel are excused. Thank you.